Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome a guest co-host, Dr. Shar Ortiz-Pujols. Welcome, Shar.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
It's really great to have you on the show today. And we're going to be able to actually hear a recent conversation that we had with psychotherapist and author Laurie Gottlieb about her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist or a Therapist in Our Lives Revealed. Really kind of the secret sauce in the therapy. I'm really excited about that type of conversation.
I am very much looking forward to that as well.
Yeah. Speaking of secret sauce, we got some research that I think has some secret sauce behind
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about our very first one. It's about exercise and teens' sleep.
This is an important topic because teenagers, adolescents in particular, they want to do so much, and we have them doing so much that when do they have time to sleep?
That's right. And we know that most teenagers don't get the 8 to 10 hours of sleep that's recommended.
Certainly
They're
not.
Doing less than 8 and sometimes even 6. And in high school, maybe even less because of the schoolwork and everything. But this actually is work that shows that if the teens engaged in moderate or vigorous physical activity, they fell asleep 18 minutes earlier. They slept 10 minutes longer and they had greater sleep efficiency that night. Ah, that's secret sauce to better sleep for teens.
Absolutely. And it was just with an extra hour of moderate to vigorous activity. And when we think of moderate, what does that mean? It means just walking more quickly, getting your heart rate up, maybe being a little bit out of breath when speaking. And so it doesn't take very much to achieve those great results.
So we have research that says it's good for the teens and probably good for everyone. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about our next research that matters about the Affordable Care Act. And this was actually on Medicaid expansion because under the Affordable Care Act, a lot of states changed and expanded their Medicaid and a lot of states didn't. And the question is, did those who expanded their Medicaid actually reduce what's called cancer-related disparities? What are cancer-related disparities, Shar?
So before the people had access to routine care, they found that especially African Americans had much worse outcomes with a similar cancer diagnosis to Caucasian or white Americans who had access to care. And these studies were finding that the reason for that is that African Americans are often not asked about symptoms that might put them at risk for cancer, or the facilities where they had access to care were too far away or just not something that they can get to that would fit their schedule. So after Medicaid expansion, the whole purpose of it is to decrease some of these barriers so that everyone could have more ready access to care.
Yeah, I think this is striking because of the almost 19,000 patients who had cancer, who did not have expansion of Medicaid compared to the 11,000 who did, that a 4.8 difference between those who got chemotherapy who were white versus African American, they got expansion. It went away. It removed this health disparity. What important ways that we think of, because we struggle so often to try to make a system of care that's more just, this appeared to do it on one really important one, mm-hmm. which is cancer care for those who are most vulnerable.
Absolutely. I mean, when they looked at it, they went from an almost 5-point difference to a less than 1-point difference. So that's a remarkable change. That's a dramatic, that's real change that came about because of opening access to care to everyone.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about opioid use and misuse, and perhaps a common assumption that, you know, for things like heroin use, that, you know, people start with opioids, maybe they're getting them from their doctors, and then they find that heroin's cheaper than the opioids, and they move in that pathway. And you know, we're really trying to clamp down on inappropriate prescribing, which is a good thing among doctors for opioids. But this suggests there's really something else going on for a lot of particularly younger people who are using heroin.
So this shifts the conversation from saying that the doctors are at fault to what about asking about the family and friends? Because this study found that many obtain their opioids from family, friends, lovers. So if we do not ask what's available at home, we may be missing many of them. And so it kind of shifts up more to educating the population at large about the dangers of opioids and how dangerous it is to share your pills.
Yeah, I've heard from, unfortunately, from family members of who've lost teenagers, you know, talking about how their teenagers got the heroin, you know, from a different family member or from a friend. They didn't start with any health care provider. And having that conversation younger, being on the alert for any signs of really substance abuse and use by adolescents, I think it's going to take us some broader efforts than what we're currently doing to make that kind of impact, because mm-hmm. it's so tragic.
It is.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, and it's one that I think is one of the most important ones we could probably be looking at, and it's a startling research and startling outcomes, and that's about kids playing violent video games, which, you know, we've known for a long time that there's probably something there, that kids who are playing these violent video games, it doesn't cause them to go out and shoot, or does it?
And so what this study, in a very rigorous manner, it kind of randomized children between the ages of 8 and 12 to two different groups. To those who played violent video games with guns, three groups. To those who had swords, and then ones who had no violence at all.
Right. These were 242 kids ages 8 to 12 playing a version of Minecraft. Haven't used it, but I've heard of it. And they played it for 20 minutes in pairs. So one was watching, one was playing, and then afterwards they would put them in a room with toys, and they also put in, maybe controversial, but it got approved by an IRB, two disabled guns that had trigger counters that had been tucked away in a cabinet. So the kids, most of the kids found the gun. And then they were tracking to see to what extent they picked up the gun, to what extent they played with the gun, to what extent they actually shot the gun, to what extent they pointed it at someone else, perhaps like they saw in the Minecraft. What did they find? Because I think this blew me away. It made me sad. It made me angry. Lots of things.
So kids who play the violent version of Minecraft were 10.1 times more likely to pick up the guns. Those who play the one with the swords were 3.6, and those who had no weapons, no monsters, were 3 times. But the most
and they were that
jarring.
That was if they were just pulling the trigger.
Just pulling the trigger.
Pulling the trigger. 10 times more likely to pull a trigger. If you saw a video game that was guns were being used, if it was just, even if it was weapons like mm-hmm. knives, they were still 3.6 times more. So,
I mean, just at 10 times more likely. I mean, that's only after 20 minutes of playing. Now, a lot of our kids play a lot more than 20 minutes.
And you were also saying, though, what about this even pulling the trigger from like pointing it at someone, including themselves?
So 3 times more likely to point it at someone else. So
if they had seen the game where there were guns being used, they were 3 times more likely to point it at someone else and pull the trigger. Versus 1.5 times, even if there were just swords. I think this is, and I hope they debrief with these kids. I'm sure they must have had extensive debriefing.
Really,
you know, this should be startling for every parent in the country around the world, that it is not harmless to play video games with violence.
And what's most terrifying to me is that this was only after 20 minutes of game time. So many of our kids spent hours and hours, and parents really need to hear some of this important research just to understand how potentially dangerous these
And if there
kids.
Are guns in the house, they have to be kept stored separately and locked so that the kids who find them, who've maybe been exposed to this for months and years, aren't so likely to pick them up and play with them and point them and pull a trigger. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're actually going to be talking with a conversation with psychotherapist and author Laurie Gottlieb about her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Cheryl Ortiz-Pujols. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Matthew Hall. Today on Conversations, Matt, we're talking with psychotherapist and well-known author Laurie Gottlieb about her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Welcome to Your Health, Laurie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I think for our listeners and so many of us who follow your work in the publishing world, it's always exciting when a new book comes out, particularly one that I think speaks to people and that people can use. Before we get into a lot of the things that you're writing, I think for our listeners, they'd love to know a little bit more about you. How did you get interested in journalism and in therapy and in taking care of people and helping provide healing?
I had a very circuitous route to becoming a therapist. When I graduated from college, I started working in television, and I was working on a show called ER, and I was a network executive, but we had a consultant on the show who was a physician, and I would spend a lot of time in the emergency room with him, supposedly for research, to come up with story ideas. But what I found was that I really liked the real life stories more than the fictional stories. And I ended up going to medical school, and while I was in medical school, I was in the middle of this big change where managed care was coming in, and a lot of my professors were talking to me about the fact that I wanted to guide people through their lives as a physician, and that that might be more difficult in the new environment. And at the same time, I started writing because, again, I was interested in story and the human condition, and this way I was able to tell people stories and go in depth into their lives in that way. But eventually, I realized that I wanted to change people's stories too, and that's what I do as a therapist.
Wow. So you started in medicine and then had a pivot or a shift into taking that beginning and burgeoning knowledge to craft a new path for yourself.
Exactly. But I think it looks like all of these different things that I did were very unrelated, you know, that I was either very versatile or very confused. And maybe I was a little bit of both, but you know, I really feel like they all have to do with story and the human condition. And it's just that each way of doing it is looking at it from a different angle. And I love the fact that I can still write and tell people stories, but I also get to be in the therapy room with people and help people's stories to evolve and change.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how you've made that transition to in the literary form to kind of help people. And I think a lot of providers don't do that. Could you talk a little bit about how the online journal has reached people and how you use that to help people?
You mean the Dear Therapist column?
Yes.
So I write a weekly column called Dear Therapist for The Atlantic, and I really wanted to do something different with the way that people approach their problems, which is instead of giving prescriptive advice like, you know, here's what you should say to your mother-in-law, I wanted to let people see what a therapist might be thinking, but not necessarily saying in that very first session when we're presented with a problem, so that they could see a different perspective and hopefully come up with a solution that works for them. Very much what we do in therapy. I write about this in the book, that when I hear somebody's story for the first time, I'm not just listening to their story. I'm not just listening to the content of the story. I'm listening to what I like to say is the music under the lyrics. What is the flexibility with the story? What is the underlying struggle or issue that got them into this situation in the first place? And that's what I like to do with the column as well.
You know, it's interesting. As a family physician, I frequently write after I've processed and experienced something in the clinic. It's like the living laboratory for writing, and I'm certain that it has to stimulate things for you. And I'm wondering if you can talk about your new book, Maybe you should talk to someone, a therapist or a therapist in Our Lives Revealed, and tell us, when was there an aha moment for you and what caused it that there was a new book waiting to be written?
I wasn't actually supposed to be writing this book, and I don't think that most people wake up and say, I'm going to write a book about myself in therapy, and particularly therapists don't do that because we tend to keep our private lives very private. But I was supposed to be writing a happiness book, and I was a new therapist at the time, and the more that I saw what was going on in the therapy room and what we were really searching for, I felt like, A, happiness was beside the point. And, you know, happiness as a byproduct of living your life a certain way is great, but happiness as an end goal in itself, I think, is doomed to disappointment and failure. But I also felt like this idea of happiness was really sort of scratching the surface of what I was seeing in the therapy room. And so what I ultimately decided to do instead was to bring people into the therapy room with me. And I originally thought about doing that simply as a clinician. And in the book, I do tell the story of these four very different patients, different ages, different genders, different family histories, different personalities, different struggles. But I felt at the same time that one of the themes of the book is that we're more the same than we are different. And I felt it would almost be disingenuous to hide behind the professional veil and not reveal something about myself as well. And so I become the fifth patient, and I bring people into the therapy room where I am the patient. So we have these five stories, one of which just happens to be mine.
Wow, interesting and revealing. I know my sister, who's a therapist in Atlanta, frequently talks about the support among other therapists. And I know that, for instance, doctors talk frequently about this, you know, with each other. But it's rare that we recognize that lots of insights come from that can help people.
That's right. We even have a case consultation group that, you know, most therapists belong to a group of colleagues where they get support for their cases, and you run a case by your group every week, and we get that kind of feedback. But I think going to therapy is different, where you get more insight into yourself, you understand yourself better so that you can bring the best version of yourself into that room to help people who are coming to you for help.
You kind of mentioned this a little bit, but it seems like part of your book and your writing involves removing the mystery of therapy and also setting expectations for patients. I wonder if you can comment
on
that.
That's right. Yeah, I really wanted to demystify the process of therapy. There are so many stereotypes surrounding, I think, what people imagine it to be. And I think it also prevents people from getting help because it doesn't seem very palatable to them. And I think what I'm trying to show in the book is that it's really this very rich human connection. Of course, we have skills and training, and we're using a lot of our education in the room. But I think what we're really using is our humanity. And I really wanted people to see what that looks like in practice as opposed to describing it. I wanted them to actually sit in the room with me with these patients, to sit in the room with me when I'm with my own therapist so that they can be a fly on the wall and get that experience by watching.
Can you share with us maybe one story that you think about in the book that illustrates one of the things that perhaps was surprising as you were either experiencing it and then writing about it, that, you know, this process of kind of catharsis that you didn't start here, but you ended with a new understanding. Is there anything that strikes you?
I think all of the stories do. I think starting with John, he's this guy who's very unlikable at the beginning. He's very abrasive. He's insulting to me. He tells me that he's come to me because I'm a nobody. And therefore, he knew he wouldn't run into any of his high-powered colleagues in my waiting room. You know, he doesn't want his wife to know he's in therapy, and so he pays me with a lot of cash at the end of each session and says, jokingly but not, you'll be like my mistress. Nobody has to know. He's very unself-aware, but also, in a way, he's really making sure that people don't get close to him. And he becomes the person that people who have read the book tend to love the most by the end of the book, because once he allows me to see him, once you can see the tragedy and the trauma underlying his behavior, he becomes so lovable and so relatable. So I think that one of the things that I hope people take away from the book is that what we are in a moment, in a snapshot of time, is not the entirety of who we are.
I think that's a good place for jumping off in our second segment, but we're going to need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with psychotherapist and best-selling author Laurie Gottlieb about her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Matt Hall. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with psychotherapist and best-selling author Laurie Gottlieb about her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist or a Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And I was just thinking right before the break about this catharsis that happens when the kind of the magic, the secret sauce in the room occurs, and how sometimes it's really difficult because secrets are there. You know, sometimes I say, though, within 15 seconds of being in the exam room, patients will tell me things that, you know, it's stranger than fiction. What's that experience like for you to both experience it, but also to write about it?
I think so many people have secrets because secrets are all about shame. Carl Jung called secrets psychic poison because they're so corrosive. But when we talk about them, all the air returns to the room. The secrets become so powerful because of the fact that they're secret. I think there's a gender difference, too. I think that men will come in and say, you know, I've never told anybody this before. And then what they tell me seems so mild to me. But to them, I think because men have so much trouble talking to each other and being vulnerable with each other, it seems like an extremely big secret to them. Women will come in and say, I've never told anybody this before, except for my mother, my sister, and my best friend, right? So they've actually told people, but it feels like they haven't told people. But I think we keep secrets from, you know, we keep secrets from the people that we love and who are close to us, but we also keep secrets from our therapists, and we keep secrets from ourselves. And I think that, again, you know, I'm sure as a physician you see that, where people come in and maybe they're embarrassed to tell you something that's really relevant to their health, but they feel a lot of shame around it, and it takes some skill to get that out of them so that you can help them. We can't help them if we don't have all the information.
Yeah, I remember a patient recently that just seemed sad, and they didn't open up for the first time in the exam room. But the second time, I said, you know, you were just sad last time, and you said there was nothing going on. And I found out that they had had a grandchild that had been arrested. And so that was too raw at that first visit. And I wonder what you can speak to about your experiences and your relationships with patients over time.
The relationship is so important because no one's going to take risks or grow or change if they don't trust the person that they're with every week. And I think it's important to realize, too, that therapy is hard work. you know, not just for the therapist, but for the patient. And they're doing a lot of things that they wouldn't normally do. And we like to say that insight is the booby prize of therapy, meaning that you can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't leave the therapy room and make changes out in the world between sessions, the insight is useless. You can say, oh, now I know why I keep getting into these arguments in my marriage. But if you go home and you do exactly the same thing in your marriage, nothing will change. And so I think that the relationship is really powerful in terms of holding you accountable while you're also being vulnerable. And those seem like two very different things, but you have to hold both of those things for the patient, that you want to hold them accountable, and at the same time, you want them to trust you. So it's a delicate balance, but it's what determines the success of someone's therapy.
You bring up many interesting topics, and I think we could talk about this for a really long time. One of the questions that I have lingering in my mind is the relationship between your practice and writing publicly, and whether that affects the relationship with your patients, and how you use that to your advantage, or maybe how it's been a disadvantage.
I think it's very different for someone to read something about me versus having a conversation with me about it. In the same way that I Googled my own therapist and I found out something about him, about that his father had died young and I had been talking about my own father. And it changed the way that I wanted to talk about my father with him. It was very different once we had the conversation about what I had found. I think it's very hard in this day and age not to have information out there about you. Now, of course, that's different for me because I was writing about myself long before I ever imagined becoming a therapist. So maybe I wouldn't have written some of those things if I knew that 10 years down the line, I would later go back to grad school and become a therapist. But I think it's all grist for the mill. I think it's all something that we can talk about and understand in the context of how it affects the patient. So we aren't there to talk about our own lives. We're not there to make it our session. But we are there to help people process whatever feelings they have about whatever information they have.
When you're in the exam room and you're kind of uncovering something that was a secret or something that someone is shameful or fearful of, you know that you have some control or power over that conversation. You have the ability to take it down deeper, and also patients get more vulnerable. How do you decide when to use your skill, your professionalism, and why at certain times to either take it a little deeper or maybe not? And do you talk about that in the book, how you actually have to make judgment calls?
Yes. In the book, I'm making judgment calls constantly with each of my patients. And it's different for each person. What is their readiness to hear something? How might I say it? How much might I say? What kind of seed will I plant this week? And it's almost like chess, where you're thinking five moves ahead. And I might not get to that fifth move for 3 months, but I know that it's there, and I'm going to look for those opportunities in the room. And it's this, we want to do two things. We want to help people struggle less more quickly. So we want to move things along for them. But at the same time, if we bring up something in the wrong way or too early, they're already defended around it. They're going to build a higher wall. And then we have a higher wall scale, and that will set them back, and it will take longer. So we're making those judgment calls all the time. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes, you know, we have to kind of fix our mistake and what we call repair. But I think we're constantly judging their readiness. When, even in the very first session, when someone comes in, I'm listening not just to, you know, why they came in, but I want to know why now, because I'm scanning for that readiness. Why this day, this week, this month did you call, even though this problem has persisted for a year? What was it that made you ready now? I'm not going to ask it that way. I'm going to ask other questions to help me assess that.
I think asking that question when they come in is incredibly important. And one of the things that I always think of is that when they take that step in, that it's a major breakthrough, or that they've made that first major step towards improving themselves or having that insight. I was wondering if you might be able to describe maybe something new that's happened recently, where maybe someone reached, they read something that you had written and reached out to you specifically about what was going on with them.
I think often people reach out to me because they've read something in my writing that resonates with them. It doesn't mean that they've had the same experience that I've had, but something made them feel known or seen or understood. And in that sense, they might want to come in and talk to me. But I don't think that people generally come in because they've experience the exact same thing that I have.
No, it strikes me that in the moments of difficulty and the really serious things that you deal with and that we deal with daily, that there is a role for laughter. And I wonder how laughter manifests itself in humor in your book and in your writing.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I talk about the patients in the book and they say, you know, one of them has cancer and, you know, one of them is going to turn 70 and her adult children won't talk to her and she's had these marriages and she has no hope. You know, I think it's interesting for people to hear that it's actually a very funny book, because I think that humor is part of the fabric of our lives. And I think that you can't just hold one thing without the other. There's pain and there's joy, and both coexist. And sometimes people who come to therapy don't realize that. I think that they're so stuck in their pain that they're not able to see their joy, or the opposite, where they say, help me not to feel. They don't want to feel anything. And I try to explain to them that you can't mute one feeling without muting the others. You can't mute the pain without also muting the joy. And so I really try to broaden people's range of their experience so that humor and joy are just woven into the fabric of whatever struggles they also have.
Before we wrap up, are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think that one of the main points of the book is that we grow in connection with others. And I hope that people will spend more time connecting with other people, whether they come to therapy or not, that instead of just liking something on Facebook, that they will actually say, hey, let's go take a walk for 15 minutes, or let's go grab a coffee. That face-to-face part of our lives is getting lost. Even in therapy, people are saying, why don't you just do Skype therapy? And a colleague of mine calls Skype therapy like doing therapy with a condom on. Because it's not the same. It's the energy in the room of being face to face with someone, of hearing them breathe, of just literally being present with somebody, can't be replicated. And I think technology is great for a lot of things, but I think we have to make sure that we haven't lost these human connections that are so vital to both our emotional and our physical health.
Yeah, I think unlike condoms, which would be perfectly safe, sometimes in the physician or provider relationship with patients, you have to be willing to take some risk to go to a place of improved health.
Absolutely. You have to be a human being in that room.
Well, we want to thank you for taking us on your journey, Laurie Gottlieb, and your new book that we're going to encourage our readers to get and engage and learn. It's called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a Therapist or Therapist in Our Lives Revealed. Thanks so much for working with us to bring this message to listeners. Laurie.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for the conversation.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Matt Hall. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura, what do we got?
I'm 65 years old, and I've had hepatitis C for decades. I've always been hesitant to have it treated because of how expensive the treatment is, and my lack of a comprehensive insurance plan to help me. I find myself being fatigued, though, almost all the time, and I have lots of other symptoms, like joint pain, that make it pretty hard to function. Do you have any advice on anything else I can do?
Thank you for writing. You know, I think we forget sometimes that hepatitis C is a virus, and viruses do infect the entire body. And so hepatitis C not only can infect the liver and can lead to liver failure and liver cancer, but it also affects and is distributed to all tissues. So fatigue and even joint pains are really common, and they're going to be chronic if that virus is circulating. If it were you and you didn't have any health insurance, or you have patients who don't have health insurance, sometimes we can try to get compassionate use or maybe get the medication free or at very low cost. This is a very expensive medication frequently. It could be up to $100,000, I know. But there may be some options to maybe advocate, work with your doctor or social worker to advocate for getting access to this medicine.
Absolutely. It's always worth a try. And sometimes if you can make the case together with your doctor, you may find someone to cover most of the costs, if not all of the costs. So definitely work with them, work with the counselors, see what other help we can give you for that. But in the meantime, unfortunately, you need to take care of yourself, eat well, sleep, so that all these symptoms that are making you feel poorly can be minimized.
And you may not be able to work. You may have to be on disability. These are things, again, your primary care provider can work with you with and to monitor this course. Laura, what's our very next house call?
Recently, I went to see my doctor for chest pain. Because I'm only 33, neither he nor I were too concerned about a heart problem. I don't smoke, but I do drink almost every day. My doctor asked if I was depressed or anxious, and while I said no, maybe I hesitated or something, because he then asked about my relationship with my spouse, which I had to admit was not ideal. Long story short, within minutes we were talking about therapy and marriage counseling, and I just wanted to share this for other people who might be experiencing something similar, because I think this was the right direction for me to go in.
Well, thank you for sharing what is something that I think happens so often. We see patients that come into our offices with things that sound serious medical problems, but they also have such a strong psychological component to it. And sometimes it's not so easy to get there. I think there was, I just heard a red flag when the doctor said, do you drink any alcohol? And it's like, yeah, I drink every day. That's a little bit of a red flag.
Mm-hmm. And I thank you very much for bringing this very important issue, because stress causes so many problems that we just don't fully appreciate. And like Adam said, you know, this heart pain that you were feeling is likely caused by the stress and the anxiety that you're feeling because of your relationship.
Yeah. And the good news is, just like taking nitroglycerin if you had a heart condition can really help you, certainly a good therapist can really help you. And it sounded like this doctor was really in tune that not only getting a marriage therapist, which will be good for the relationship to figure out which direction and how to improve it, but also for you, because the marriage therapist will not necessarily be your therapist. It'll be both of your therapists.
And taking care of your own mental health is one of the most important things that you can do to live a long and healthy life. And therapist is the ideal person to help you work through some issues.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
My mother's almost 90, and she recently fell when she missed the last step outside of her apartment. Luckily, she didn't fracture anything, but she did have bruises all over her face. I've noticed that she seems to be having more balance problems recently despite seeing a physical therapist. Should she be in a walker or a wheelchair at this point?
Well, first off, I'm glad she wasn't seriously injured. We hear that story all the time, and people mm-hmm. break their hips, and that's the start of
and
a can bad transition.
Fall on their face and have some very serious fractures on
and be
their
very
face.
Scary and be scared to walk and get out. Here, we mm-hmm. want to maintain independence. We want to maintain mm-hmm. that independent living. And I think a walker is a way of, for many people, of maintaining independence and maintaining the ability to walk, because it may be that, and particularly if you've tried physical therapy, to, you know, if there's not medications that you're taking that are in the problem or something else medically, that maybe you need something else to help you when you're walking, and that is short of actually getting a wheelchair.
And don't forget to look at the home, because there are so many things at home that can increase our risk of falling.
Like?
Area rugs, having too much clutter, making it more difficult for you to move around things. Clear the spaces. Get rid of things that your foot can get caught on. And that will also minimize falls at home, because those can be even more dangerous than the ones outside, because people may not find you until days later. Outside, you're likely to be found by someone. But at home, people can be there for days.
I see people with socks, and the socks on a floor that's really slippery. It's mm-hmm. like ice skating.
Yes, it is. So just making sure that the home is safe and looking at it with new eyes, given your new circumstances.
And maybe a walker maybe is used indoors as well as outdoors. So
absolutely.
I would ask the physical therapist, maybe even occupational therapist, mm-hmm. would this benefit you?
Absolutely. And have them maybe even come out to your home and take a look at things too. They can be incredibly helpful.
Great words of advice. Well, we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or use our health app. I'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my great guest co-host today, Dr. Shiara Ortiz-Pujols and Dr. Matt Hall with their interview with Laurie Gottlieb. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.